This is FM 100.5, 101.9, AM 1450, and WGNSradio.com. Rutherford County's place to talk.
This is The Truman Show with Truman Jones. A look at the politics, news, sports, and people that are shaping Rutherford County. Now your host, Truman Jones.
And good morning, Rutherford County. It is going to be a great day. It's Greg Tucker's show today, and I'm just going to sit back and let him take care of it, as usual. And this part of his show is brought to you by At Home Care. And when you and your family members need assistance for a day, a week, or indefinitely, At Home Care is ready to sit down with you and help devise a practical plan to meet your family's needs. At Home Care is different than any others you see in the local marketplace because they're owned and operated by longtime Murfreesboro resident Melissa Warren. That means that home care is hands-on and involved in your family members' care and satisfaction all day, every day. At Home Care provides top-quality professional caregiving services throughout Rutherford County and Middle Tennessee. Whether you need a 24/7 companion, ongoing assistance with transportation to church or doctor's appointments, laundry, housekeeping, personal care, or more, At Home Care is here for you. At Home Care, 713-4639, online, athomecaretennessee.com. That's 713-4639. Good morning, Greg.
Well, good morning. What do we call this weather? Is this Indian winter?
I call it crummy. Well, because everybody's sick.
Yeah, well, the variability can...
Brian, get back there on your side. We got a lot of sick ones running around here.
I'm flattered. We got Mr. Bart himself.
Yeah, dressed panel. To the hilt. Oh, my goodness. Is he looking good?
He's got a rotary meeting, I hear.
Yeah.
No, I dressed for your show.
So did I, Bart.
Truman has a tuxedo on.
Yes.
Really dapper looking.
You know, I can't afford to buy one, so I'm renting this thing just for the show.
And I hope everybody appreciates it. It's got a big T on it.
Yeah.
I want to know where you get a tux with a big T on it.
I wasn't going to say tux. Anything about that, but the... orange tuxedo is a little different.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like I could be in a rock band right now. That's what I should be doing, is performing where people could actually see me.
Well, and you look sharp for that. Hey,
Thank you.
The cummerbund with the lights on it, that looks good. The blinking lights.
And my MTSU.
For dancing in the dark.
Yeah, that's true. You guys are dangerous.
You know, when Greg came in this morning, he brought in some pictures, and they took me back a long, long way. Of course, it was before I was born, some of them.
One of your predecessors, Wash Powers.
Yes, and it was at the One Gallus Fox Camp, part of it was,
right.
And the other part was in front of the old jail. Now, this is before the jail that was facing West Main Street, at the corner of West Main and Front. This is the one that they tore down on that property that actually faced the old post office, and they were standing on the steps there, I guess maybe after an election or whatever, they all were getting their pictures taken. And it was, if you want to see what Rutherford County was probably back in the late 30s and something like that, that was what it was.
Well, apparently the entire deputy force was not uniformed, or at least they certainly weren't on that day.
No, they had on Sunday go to meeting clothes.
Yeah, but most of them were carrying their sidearm. I was impressed. You were quick to recognize that the pictures were the same guys, just in one of them they were posing in front of their jail, I guess, with their coats on, and then they relaxed a little later. It looked like each one of them had a bottle or something, but we could tell by a car in the picture that it was back during the era of Prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
So naturally, you taking up for your kind said it obviously was soft drinks they were drinking.
It just looked like it was in beer bottles. It was probably just Coca-Cola, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And at the One Gallus Fox Camp, that's what really got me, because they had to have been celebrating something special. It was either after an election or something, or maybe they had had a big bust or whatever.
Well, maybe they just were posing for pictures for a certain use.
Yeah.
The club itself physically was a little bit south of Eagleville,
mm-hmm.
on the pike going down
going
towards
Chapel Hill.
Yeah, mm-hmm. towards Chapel Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And I have been told that they actually did some fox hunting.
It was a place where I have been told, I don't know firsthand, but people came from everywhere to fox hunt there. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing. I've had some stories. I've told them on the air before, so I'm not going to tell them again. I'll wait till everybody's memory has gone.
Next generation listeners. Well, I know there was also a fox preserve, if you want to call it that was either owned or rented by some Atlanta business people who came up here, and it was over, it'd be east of Fosterville in the hills back in there. And I don't know whether the one Gallus used the same area or whether that was another area.
I don't know, but one of the places, and it may be the same area, people would come even from England to do fox hunting.
Oh my goodness.
Which is, you know, the horses, they had the everything.
Did they?
It wasn't just the dogs running.
And I wonder, were they taking gray foxes as well as red, or were they only interested in the pretty red fox?
Well, you know, the red fox is the most interesting, as you know, living in the country. I mean, they're absolutely beautiful, and you rarely see them. I think I've seen maybe one red fox in the last year or so. It's rare.
Yeah, they are. The most of them I see aren't pure red. They look like they're kind of a mixed.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like when you see the squirrels, you see the fox squirrels and the gray squirrels and all that.
Right, you hardly ever see a full red squirrel anymore.
No, but the fox squirrels, you know, we used to hunt back then, and the fox squirrels were by far the most interesting. I could sit there and watch them all day. We have a caller on the line. So, caller, welcome aboard with Greg Tucker.
One of the late John Bragg's favorite stories is one got us Fox Hunters Club. Uncle Dave Macon was there to make a little appearance one evening, and Uncle Dave noticed some men going back and forth to their horses and wagons, extracting some liquid to consume. And later that evening, they asked Uncle Dave if he would like to say a blessing before the evening meal. Uncle Dave turned them down and said, "No, I don't want God to know I'm here."
That fits Uncle Dave, doesn't it? Oh, before we go any further, Dan, I'd like you to know that Rob was not. Did he go off already?
He did.
Did he hang up on me?
He most certainly
he
did.
He knew what I was coming back on him. Oh, I can't say it now.
Maybe he's listening. Maybe he's listening on the radio.
Yeah. Oh man, if anybody doesn't recognize that voice, of course it's Dan Whittle.
Was that Dan Whittle?
Yeah, and you remember Rob Lyons was at the door, and he was saying that he was supposed to meet Whittle somewhere to eat, and Whittle didn't even show up, and he said that is the second time. Now, can you imagine standing up the city manager? That just doesn't happen.
There'll be repercussions, as they say.
Did you get to read the little magazine that I gave you that Danny Jones has lent me, and I still got to get it back to him? Real Detective.
Yeah, it was real detective treatment of our own story about Albert Dubois.
Mm-hmm.
And
Dubois.
I almost said Dubois, but my wife speaks French, and I'm afraid I'm influenced. It makes a very engaging story, knowing the detailed facts. I obviously saw that it had been embellished and enhanced quite a bit.
Looks like Whittle had written it, didn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, add a little drama to it, a little more drama than it was. But those detective stories, because that was what true stories are true. There were four or five of them, uh-huh. And extremely popular following the post-war years, the 50s. Now, I guess with television and everything else, that there's not as much of a readership for it. But
no, because you got, City Confidential and all those other shows that are on now that actually go all the way across the country, and they've brought in a number of cases that actually happened here in Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
And just the way he relates the story back to everybody, it makes it so interesting. But when I was reading that story, to be honest with you, I couldn't put it down. It captured my imagination, because, you know, we have heard about so many of the things that we've read about, but from our parents and our grandparents.
Right.
Now to bring them to light, to the same pr- pretty much close to the same time it happened. Right. Really, really makes it more interesting because well, I can't say that it enhances the truth, but maybe in some respects it does.
Well, the writing style reminded me probably one of your popular writers, Louis L'Amour.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And he wrote not only the Westerns, he wrote a lot of detective, true detective kind of stories. And
no, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. And his character is always an ex-boxer or an amateur boxing because, you know, he was into boxing. But, yeah, and his favorite characters were private detectives, but he also profiled a lot of law enforcement personnel and such. And when I read the magazine, I thought this, because L'Amour was writing about the same period, and as an obvious style there.
You know, a lot of the great mystery novels always have private detectives in them, and I've always wondered where they received their authority. They must have been a whole lot different back then than it is now, because they were pretty much out on a limb, you'd think.
And it seems, and I'll confess to having read a number of them, and there's two types. There's the ones that have buddies and close friends in the law enforcement community they can call on, and they're the ones that are always at odds with the law enforcement community.
And they're always smarter, which gets me.
Yeah, and why would that?
All right. I always took offense to that.
You know, some of your listeners may not realize that at one time you were our county sheriff for quite a period. And I heard a story from one of your deputies that I thought was amusing.
It had to have been amusing.
Yeah, it was amusing. Well, you weren't in the story, only indirectly.
But oh, good.
He was struggling with a mean drunk who was giving him a bad time. And a lot of back and forth while he tries to handle himself professionally. And finally the drunk says, "I'm going to get you in trouble. I'm going to get you fired. I'm a close friend of Thurman Jones."
How many times I heard that?
And Jack Vaughn says, he told him, "Well, if you get me fired, I won't lose much."
The good old days.
Yeah, yeah. And then I had another question for you. There's some people I know who call you Butch.
Yes.
Where did Butch come from?
I was a junior, or am a junior, and they didn't want to call me the same name as my father because they called him Truman. So they tried to figure out what they're going to call me, and basically, for some reason, Butch came into the, and I don't know why, because, you know, I was a pretty nice guy. I was rough and all that kind of, as you relate to the name Butch. And so I guess it was just something that somebody said and just stuck with me, because everybody that I grew up with called me Butch up until I got into high school. And then they called me Truman.
That was your preference, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think a lot of it maybe started with Gilbert Sharon, because when I played for him in Little League Baseball, he called me Truman, so it stuck. So I was with a new group. I went from Kittrell Community over to Mitchell Nelson after I started playing ball in the city, and I just kind of changed, not changed personality, but I did change names. And I always preferred, today I prefer my name Truman, but I also answer to Butch, because I kind of prefer that when it comes from my friends. It's what you get used to.
I see. Well, Truman or Thurman, that's kind of classy names. They got a little
No. I'll take Truman. Actually, I've been called Truman. Yeah, it just depends. I mean, how in the world can you get so many different names out of a simple name like Truman? I bet Harry S. was never called Thurman.
Called Harry S., probably. Yeah, and the S stood for nothing.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, and if you wrote it correctly, you did not put a period. Harry S. with no period, Truman. Is that a correct way to write it?
You know, you think back to the people that have meant so much to this country, and you think of the ones that have just an extraordinary aptitude for the job. Harry S. Truman was a haberdasher. And he came into the most powerful job in the world and did an extraordinary job while he was there. It's amazing how people can step up mm-hmm. to whatever the responsibility is. Some people can, not all can.
Well, he was a successful clothing salesman,
yes.
which means he had some business sense, which mm-hmm. I think is an important part of assuming executive authority. We don't always see. And historians now will rank Truman in the top five in terms of great effective presidents. And he was back then, and perhaps a lot still, the presidential nominee looks for a vice president that brings a constituency or a voter appeal that, you know, the presidential candidate didn't have. And Roosevelt, you know, saw a nice small town businessman mm-hmm. who had, I don't even think he was a senator. Was he a congressman at the time? He was. Mm-hmm. He was in politics. So. And then Roosevelt dies fairly early in that fourth term, and Truman has to wind up the post-war and very, very difficult time.
You think Roosevelt chose him because he may not have been a competitor or maybe, I'm not too sure, Truman at the time was even interested in becoming president or maybe even vice president at the time.
Well, if he was at all aware of Roosevelt's circumstances, the odds were Roosevelt wasn't going to live another 4 years.
Polio.
Yeah. I was reading, well, not just polio, but he had just returned from Yalta. I read recently his speech to Congress reporting on his Yalta experience. And I have one friend here in town, Bobby Huddleston, who was there and remembers that the president simply did not look good. You know, it was evident from his appearance that he was going down. The stress of the war, and some historians will say we didn't do all that well negotiating with our allies at the end of the war, and it may have been in part because of Roosevelt's health.
Stalin had a upper hand, it seemed like, in part of it.
Yeah, and the deal they made, Stalin agreed that Russia would declare war and join in the war on Japan, and they did virtually nothing in that respect. And in exchange, you got half of Europe.
Yeah.
So I think there was some tough bargaining there.
Your dad had a big part in the war.
Yeah.
We have steered away from that for a long time.
Well, I had one story that's kind of a personal story that I'll share. You know, there's an awful lot, and I don't want to get into the tragedy, and it certainly was, but there's an awful lot of talk about guns and gun control and gun collectors mm-hmm. and such as that. And part of the, not tradition, but the habit of any time that the American forces have gone overseas, the soldiers, the rank and file, collect souvenirs.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of my father, he was a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And the pilots were at a sharp disadvantage because they weren't on the ground when there may have been souvenirs to be collected. Mm-hmm. So my father had to go to a little bit of extra effort to bring home a couple of souvenirs from the Solomon Islands when he was there.
Let's just take a quick break because we've got a caller on the line.
All right.
Caller, welcome aboard with Greg Tucker.
You know, they weren't very patient, Truman.
Oh, no. Okay, let's continue with the story.
Well, we've got a news break.
So oh, do we?
You want to do that, and then maybe they'll call back.
You're just determined to interrupt Greg, aren't you?
All right, go ahead, Brian. Let's hear your news.
Right now, one in three drivers is cruising around in a state of skepticism about just how much value their car insurance company is delivering. If you're one of them, I'm State Farm Agent Celeste Middleton, and I can help you get to a better state because I'll talk with you, listen to you, and help you put together a policy that has you written all over it, all backed by 24/7 customer support. Feeling less skeptical? Give me a call at 895-2700.
Get to a better state, State Farm.
I'm State Farm Agent Celeste Middleton. Give me a call at 895-2700.
Do you have a recovery plan for your investments? This is Lee Colvin, your Edward Jones Financial Advisor. And while no one can control the market, you can take advantage of investment opportunities that exist today, such as attractive prices on quality investments. At the same time, it is important to be well positioned for whatever the market does tomorrow. Call me, Lee Colvin, at 907-7056, or stop by my office today on Rutherford Boulevard in the Public Shopping Center. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
Since 1940, your first choice for air conditioning and heating repairs has been Roscoe Brown. Now, when you have plumbing problems, it's also Roscoe Brown. You can depend on Roscoe Brown for any type of plumbing service and innovative plumbing solutions. Roscoe Brown is fully licensed, bonded, and insured, and fully qualified to assist with heating, air conditioning, and now plumbing. Roscoe Brown. Phone 888-MY-ROSCOE.
Everyone loves Stones River Manor.
We also have a new library. People from all over is giving us books. We have any kind of book, I guess, that you would want to read, we have in our library.
Stones River Manor, behind Riding, at the intersection of Haines and Memorial. Stop by Stones River Manor for a tour. Ask for Mike Gann. Stones River Manor, it's home.
This is Chip Walters, and I'll have Middle Tennessee football and basketball games for you right here.
MTSU Sports on WGNS AM, FM, online.
Tennessee Radio Network News, I'm Jim Williams. The trial continues in Knoxville of Joseph Underwood. He's the homeless guy charged with killing a man who let Underwood and his girlfriend stay at his house. Underwood admits he attacked 52-year-old Richard Lucas, bound him up with duct tape, and stuffed him alive into a plastic storage container in November of 2011. But Underwood denies stabbing Lucas in the neck. He claims his girlfriend Kimberly Sutton did that. Underwood and Sutton are being tried separately for the killing. Lucas's body was found in that storage bin inside a shed at his house. A mid-state traffic crash has taken two lives and caused several other injuries.
A mother is fighting for her life after a Monday night crash killed two others and injured her two-week-old baby and three-year-old daughter in Robertson County. The cause of that crash not immediately known. The Tennessee Highway Patrol is assisting with the investigation.
TRN's Tanya J. Powers. 25-year-old Hawkins County resident James McFarland told a Churchill police officer he didn't go anywhere or steal anything. The officer he was talking to hadn't mentioned anything about theft, but McFarland then told the cop he didn't take anything from school. Officer Dustin Dean told McFarland he hadn't mentioned a school either when he said he wanted to talk to him and advised him of his rights. The witness tells police McFarland was near the Churchill Elementary on the 22nd of this month. That was last Wednesday. He was dressed similar to a thief captured on surveillance video. $250 taken from an office safe there. After McFarland implicated himself, he was arrested for burglary, theft, and vandalism.
This is Freda Morgan with First National Bank in Murfreesboro. If you're in the market for a loan of any sorts, please call my friend Steve Smith and let Steve show you the personalized service available at First National Bank of Murfreesboro. We're conveniently located at 2230 Mercury Boulevard. Again, please call Steve Smith, 615-494-4200 at First National Bank of Murfreesboro. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
We're looking for the right insurance company for our auto, home, and life.
We went with Claiborne & Taylor. They've been around for years. Claiborne & Taylor. They used to be Farmer Brothers Insurance and Murfreesboro Insurance Agency. They're one of Murfreesboro's largest locally owned independent agencies.
I'm Doran Claiborne.
And I'm Gary Taylor.
Farmer Brothers Insurance and Murfreesboro Insurance Agency are now Claiborne & Taylor Insurance. Our office is at 319 West McKnight Drive, just off Memorial Boulevard behind Tirewood.
You can depend on Claiborne & Taylor.
Governor Haslam offered the legislature his third yearly State of the State address last night. In it, his annual budget proposal seeks to boost Tennessee's educational performance with more than $300 million for improvements at the colleges and universities. It also calls for a shakeup at DCS.
Governor Haslam's spending plan of nearly $33 billion includes a staffing shakeup at the troubled Department of Children's Services, a heavy investment into construction projects around the state, and a large deposit into the state's cash savings fund. He presented it to state lawmakers last night.
TRN's Dan Item, Jim Williams, TRN News.
WeatherEye.
Let's get a check of the forecast now with staff meteorologist Sam Denisky. 60 degrees, cloudy skies, and storms on the way, Sam.
Well, Brian, we're looking at more cloud cover in our forecast today and even more so tonight. And we could even see some strong to severe showers and thunderstorms in our forecast as well before a big cool down is in store as a strong cold front moves in from the northwest. Ahead of the cold front, however, we'll have mild high temperatures today topping off near 70 degrees. We're down to lows near 58 tonight as those showers and thunderstorms kick off, and then we could see more storms on Wednesday with an early high of 61. From the WeatherEye Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Sam Donaisky.
We're at 60 right now. Our WGNS Good Neighbor of the Day, Andrea Pinkerton, who works at Rockvale Elementary. She was nominated because she always puts everyone else before herself. Today, she receives flowers, compliments of Ryan's Flowers and Gifts. And Pommy Hayes is our WGNS birthday cake winner, receiving the cake today from Junior's Foodland. You had an accident and the guy's bloodthirsty lawyer wants to sue you. How would you protect yourself? Affordable liability insurance from Safe Auto. For not a lot of money, you can protect yourself from your own mistakes. Call 1-800-SAFE-AUTO now. Drive safe, spend less. Safe Auto.
He knows Rutherford County's past, and his wisdom can give good insight into our future. It's the Truman Show. Here again, Truman Jones.
Welcome back with Greg Tucker, and I think we have a caller on the line. Caller, welcome aboard with Greg Tucker.
Good morning, good morning. I enjoy you guys, and especially enjoy Greg's storytelling. And it was my understanding that he was going to talk about one of our more infamous residents, a little Ned Carmack, and I was anxious to hear that story. I've been not a student, but I've found it interesting to read the Carmack Cooper case, and I was hoping that he would enlighten us a little bit more about the resident Ned Carmack. So I'll hang up and listen, guys.
Hey, that's a good question.
All right, we'll save that. We'll save the story about the rifles. Ned Carmack, for those who wouldn't know, Ned Carmack was a junior.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Edward Carmack, named for his father. His father had been one of the most powerful politician journalist in the state back around 1900 to 1910. He was frequently used the Tennessean, the paper he owned, for his political to advance his political agenda.
Of course.
And naturally aggravated a number of people who were the victims of his poison pen. He was confronted by one of those characters right in front of the state capitol in about 1908. He drew first, expecting that they were after him. He drew first, fired, and hit the fellow's son who was with him, grown son who was with his father, but only a minor injury. The son also was carrying a pistol, and he was a far better shot. He pulled his pistol, fired twice, I think, and killed the senior Carmack. At the time, Ned was about 8 years old. When Ned was in college out at Vanderbilt, actually I believe he may have been in law school, but he was about 21, 22 years old. The fellow who had gotten off on a self-defense and probably a fair judgment, Carmack had pulled the pistol and fired first. The fellow who had gotten off and was still running his business was found murdered. The body was found in Richland Creek. Ned was immediately a suspect in that case. But several acquaintances of Ned's quickly alibied, and he was no longer a suspect. And a few years later, they did identify the fellow was a gambler, and it was a gambling debt type thing. So Ned was not responsible. But Ned, his biographer said he never quite found his role in life. He obviously idolized his father, wanted to be like his father, and in a sense capitalized on his father's reputation. After he got out of school, Ned comes to Murfreesboro and leases the Daily Newspaper. It was the brand new Daily News Journal. Now, the Daily News Journal traces its history way back into the 19th century, but it actually became the Daily News Journal in about 1930 when the Murfreesboro Daily News and the Home Journal, the Daily News failed. Home Journal was owned by A.L. Todd. Todd ended up owning both papers and merged them, creating the Daily News Journal. Todd apparently wasn't interested in running a newspaper. He leased it to Ned Carmack. And Ned relocates down here in Murfreesboro with ambitions of being a political power and a crusading journalist. Mm-hmm. He takes over the Daily News Journal. Suffice it to say that 8 years later, he lost the newspaper for business reasons. He ran unsuccessfully for the Senate. And by the late 1950s, early 60s, in his declining years, he had settled into kind of the role of a local eccentric, still with powerful friends and a lot of connections, known all over the state, but an eccentric. One of his close friends locally that he had been involved politically with had a son, and had several sons, but his youngest son, I assume because of the relationship between Carmack and his father, he got to be kind of an errand boy for Ned Carmack. So in the early 60s, the young man gets a phone call from Carmack, and he says, you need to drive me to Atlanta. I'm going to have a medical procedure. And the reason he needed a driver, although Ned was still driving himself most of the time at that time, was he was concerned that while driving on the trip home, he wouldn't be able to sit comfortably and drive himself home. So he asked the young man to drive him down there. As they're driving down, he explains that he learned of a physician in Atlanta area. Now, he probably picked this up in the Real Detective magazine, that could do an implant. And that this implant, even for post 60, 70 year old, would make him a new man. And for an implant, you've got to have a donor. Well, the donor in this case was a ram, a male sheep. And the procedure was supposedly going to be done on a day basis. But the agreement with the physician was that Carmack needed to come down to Atlanta and check into a particular hotel. And the doctor would then come by the hotel and examine the prospective patient to be sure he was a good candidate for this implant. And so they went to the hotel, they checked in, the phone call was made, and the doctor showed up. And the young man, who a personal friend now, remembers that the examination was rather perfunctory, and to no one's surprise, at least in hindsight, Carmack was deemed appropriate for the procedure.
I presume the insurance company was going to buy onto this, right?
I wonder if they met the donor. The donor was going to lose its manhood, and it was going to make a new man. That was Carmack's phrase, make a new man out of him. So the doctor came by and said, you're a good candidate, and of course we need to pay at least half of the fee in advance in cash. Carmack had been advised of this before he left Murfreesboro, so he had the money and they made the payment. And then Carmack says, well, before you leave, and the doctor told him, said, you know, be at this hospital at this hour tomorrow morning and we'll do the procedure. And Carmack says, well, would you like a drink? And the doctor said, well, yeah, all right. So they sat down and had a drink. And then they had another drink. And the young man said they just kept drinking. Somewhere around midnight, the doctor, obviously a little bit beyond, remembered that he had an appointment in the morning and needed to get on home and okay. So the doctor goes out a bit unsteady. And about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, the desk rings into the room. The young man answers the phone, and they said to the desk, says, we have an urgent message. The doctor so-and-so called and said that he'll have to postpone the procedure. And by the way, would Mr. Carmack be able to make bond for him? Because he got picked up for drunk driving on the way home. And, wanted Carmack to come down and make bond for him down at the jailhouse early that morning. Carmack thought better of it. And the next morning, out of curiosity, they called the hospital. And the hospital was not aware of that doctor, that name, or any kind of appointment. And so The young man drove Carmack back home to Tennessee, and Carmack was not a new man.
Did anybody get to read about the story in the Daily News Journal?
I have not found in the file that particular story. In fact, I'm not sure Norman, the young man, has told many of that story. I thought even someone as educated and supposedly as sophisticated as Ned Carmack, although he was a bit eccentric, would fall for a scam like that. And today it just seems ridiculous. But, you know, in the early 60s, we still were very primitive when it came to implants and restoration of youthful capabilities that generally decline with age.
Now, you know, as a historian, you have to marvel at how most of us look at history. And we look at, you know, who owned the papers, when, and some of the interesting stories that were there. But we never get to look behind the scenes. And that's what makes it so interesting. I have always wondered about the personalities of the people who run newspapers. Because you see a lot of the way they think that actually ends up in print in the newspapers. But you always wonder what is the real story behind what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Because you're right, the newspapers were extremely powerful during that period of time. And of course it's switched over now from into television, and radio has actually, it was strong back then, but I think it's actually
well, the last 4 or 5 years has demonstrated that probably the dominant media now is what we call the social media. President Obama very effectively in his first campaign was kind of the first to make use of it. And obviously the power of the newspapers, which used to be the sole source for most people for news, political information and such, has been diluted considerably. But in the 1900s, you know, a man who controlled a state newspaper like the Tennessean was a political boss. You know, rival the Crump machine. In fact, Carmack, in his heyday years when he was running for office, was a staunch opponent of the old machine, the Crump machine that controlled the state, was actually very liberal in his views for the 1930s, and had some very strong allies among what we, well, you remember everything was Democrats back then.
Yes.
But as is, I think, inevitable.
Or Dixiecrat.
Yeah, well, that's what we're what I was talking about.
Yeah.
Inevitably, when one group or one party gets complete control, they split. Because you, again, have the rivalry within. We may be seeing that now in the local politics again, state politics. But there was a liberal wing of the Democrats in the 30s, and then the kind of old guard Crump machine wing, and Carmack was in the anti-Crump group, and others in the area were such as Dr. Lyons. Actually, he was not a PhD, but they called him Dr. Lyons, who was the president of the university, was very much a Crump man. So, you know, there was a friction and a rivalry, just, you know, whatever came up.
But, you know, it has seemed to work. You think of how it comes about with the control factor and the power that's within. And we all have seen that the power is not always in the offices that people hold.
Right.
It's the ones who have them put in the office. That seems to be such an interesting way of developing into those things.
I think probably it was a healthy political environment in the 1930s here, because Carmack had one newspaper and Minor Bragg had the other. And you could count on, if the Rutherford Courier gave you one point of view, you'd get the other point of view in the Daily News Journal within a few days. I have said several times, I think the Rutherford Courier in the 30s was the superior paper in terms of writing and editorial position and such as that. Carmack was flashy, and he was the daily paper. The Rutherford Courier was twice weekly. But the Courier was usually a little more in-depth, a little better writing style than the News Journal.
And now we have a caller on the line. Caller, welcome aboard with Greg Tucker.
Yes, thank you. Good morning, Mr. Truman. I was wondering if your guest would finish the story that he started earlier about the World War II, the pilot collecting souvenirs.
All right.
I'd like to hear that story finished, please.
Yes, sir.
All right, we have a little time. The South Pacific, the Solomon Islands, the Stepping Stones, were the Marines. The Navy was there a little bit, but the Marines were both on the ground, in the air, and on the water. The ground troops would clear the immediate island and then move forward. And the CBs would come in behind them, and they were the ones that did the cleanup, put down the plates so the pilots could come in, the squadrons. And then the squadron's job was, based on a secure island, to go forward ahead of the ground troops and soften things up, which meant the CBs were the ones that got the souvenirs and did all the pickup. The ground troops had to move on. They had a job to do, and the pilots and the planes hadn't come in yet. So my father, who wanted to bring home a few souvenirs, and I recall two beautiful Japanese rifles, he had to negotiate and bargain and trade with the CBs to get the souvenirs. As a child, I was assigned at about 12 years old, the keeper of the rifles. I was supposed to polish and clean and maintain them. One of them was right out of a crate. The CB had found an unopened crate of new rifles. And I thought it was beautiful. The wood was still a bright cherry red, and the metal had that bluish tint to it. And we figured it was about a 29 caliber. At that time, most of the Allies were using 30 caliber, and I'm told, I don't know this for sure, but the Japanese were smart enough to make their ammunition just a little off, so if the ammunition was captured, it couldn't be used mm-hmm. by the Allies, so they had 29. The other one was a 31, and the 31 had been in the field, had been in the mud, had been carried, and showed some wear and tear, and I took care of them and continued to take care of them after my father's death, and I have them in the county now. But with a lot of the talk around, it prompted me at Christmas time to give my son, my youngest son, who's very interested in firearms as a hobby, the gun that was not the one out of the crate, but the one that had been in the field. And I passed it to him with a little note that said, it's your turn now to take care of this item. And, of course, he knew the history, and I repeated it for him in the note, where it came from and how it came to be in the family. He took it home, and about a week later came back and brought me a piece of it.
Uh-oh.
The metal. He had taken the gun apart, which I had never really done. I had opened it and serviced it, but hadn't really taken it down to its pieces, and showed me some markings on the underside. And I knew on the other gun, they had the chrysanthemum, you know, the mm-hmm. Imperial Japanese mark right on top of it, above the bolt. And this gun had no markings that you could see until he took it apart and turned it over. It turns out that this gun was not made in Japan. This particular gun, the Japanese had limited manufacturing capabilities and resources, and they lived off their conquered nation, so to speak. Mm. When they invaded China, the land war into China in about 1938, they overwhelmed their ability to produce field arms. And it was about this time that they joined the Axis. And part of their motivation, the Japanese motivation, was to get access to some of the European manufacturing capabilities, in particular the Italians that were gun makers. And the Japanese Empire essentially contracted with a number of Italian gun makers to copy their rifle, their field arm, and provide for the Japanese forces. At least five, I think, different gun makers in Italy were involved. And they apparently were given a Japanese gun. I wish I could call the name, but it's a well-known name. And they, however, used wood available in Italy, which was a much denser and heavier wood in the stock and the wooden parts of the gun. And then they built the metalworks of the gun, where it would fit the same Japanese bayonet, the same ammunition. The bolt worked the same, everything worked the same, but they made it out of, they made the barrel a good bit longer,
mm-hmm.
and made the metal stronger, heavier, and produced, actually, we would note today, a superior gun. And if I compare the two I've got, yeah, the rougher one is the superior weapon. Also made it heavier to the small Japanese soldier at that time, considerably heavier. Ends up the only about 100 to 120,000 of the guns were made because the Japanese just did not like the gun. It was good for one thing. If you were a sniper, the longer barrel gave you the longer range. But to carry it in the field, you know, as you were moving forward or advancing or whatever in the field, it was too heavy. They didn't like it. So they only made about 120,000. That may sound like a lot of guns, but most of the guns made during that period were made in the millions to supply the Axis powers and the Allies. My son found the markings that it is a, and I can call the name because I got a note here. It is a Carcano Type 1 made in Italy.
You say that's well known. I've never heard of it.
Well, if you're, I hope there's some gun collectors that can give me a little more information on it. I don't care about the value because we'd never let the gun get out of the family, either one of them. But it's Carcano, C-A-R-C-A-N-O. Very few of them made, and you won't know for sure until you break it down and look at the bottom side of the barrel that is covered by the stock. Routinely.
All right, we're going to take a quick break of Greg Tucker's show and let you know this portion of the show is brought to you by Charlie Pitts Hair Styling on Las Casas Pike. He provides quality haircuts and styling for men, women, and children. You can call him at 895-3997, 895-3997. That's Charlie Pitts Hair Styling, and it's not just a hairstyle or a haircut. It's an experience, and believe me, it is an experience.
This is Rich Mint with more winter savings at Haynes Tree Valley Hardware. Keep your windshield clear with Extreme Blue Windshield Washer Fluid from Haynes Tree Valley Hardware. A 1 gallon container is only 99 cents while supplies last. This all-weather formula is effective in temperatures up to 20 degrees Fahrenheit and removes road grime, film, and bugs. It's perfect for temperatures up to 20 degrees Fahrenheit, so stock up today. 99 cents while supplies last. Shop the entire store for more great deals at Haynes Tree Valley Hardware. Haynes Tree Valley Hardware on Memorial behind Reeves Sane Drugstore.
If you have ever had shingles or know someone that has, you know how painful this virus may be. If you are 60 or over, and whether you have had shingles or not, it is recommended that you receive Zostavax. Only one immunization is all you will ever need. It lasts a lifetime. And if you have had shingles, this vaccination will reduce the chance that you will ever have it again. Shingles is not something to gamble with. Visit Reeves St. Drug Store, Monday through Friday, no appointment necessary. Reeves St. Drug Store, 1801 Memorial Boulevard.
To bag the deer of a lifetime, you have to be prepared. That's why you need to shop Murfreesboro Outdoors.
This is Randy at Murfreesboro Outdoors. We get camouflage clothes, shotguns, shells.
Murfreesboro Outdoors on Northwest Broad Street.
You're listening to The Truman Show on WGNS, AM and FM. Now, back to Truman Jones.
And welcome back with Greg Tucker. And this part of the show is brought to you by Murfreesboro Automotive. When you need car repairs, you want someone you can trust. Murfreesboro Automotive is that place. Chuck Haynes has a staff of certified technicians that can fix anything. From the simple oil change to major auto repair, Murfreesboro Automotive is the only place you need. Murfreesboro Automotive, turn off Broad between Chewy's and Chili's onto Ridgely Road. You know, as usual, we've been all over the place, and it's usually me leading you, but we're letting the audience kind of take part a little bit and more, and that's kind of fun.
And we've been from sheep to man transplants to Japanese rifles. That's a pretty good scope.
And we could have gone from sheep down in Atlanta to the Black Sheep Squadron. We could have gone there,
too.
Well,
that could have been a tie-in, couldn't it?
Yeah. But
I'm not, well, it is a mature audience, so.
You know, with a mature audience, and some of us that remember some of the history of what went on in World War II, your father was a major part of the story the soldiers and the flyers and the Air Force, the Navy, and all of that combined. It all just kind of merges together.
A small part of an interesting part, at least. And, you know, I tell people that my father was part of probably, or certainly, the best known, the most famous air fighting unit in the history of the United States.
Right.
And I think it'd be hard to challenge me on that, because there was a made-for-TV movie, there was a movie series, there's been 6 or 7 books written mm-hmm. about the Black Sheep. And, you know, you step back and you think, why did this particular group get so much attention? And there's kind of a universal lesson there, and I'm going to save that for another show.
Oh, no. Okay, when are we going to actually get this story? Are we going to get it next time?
If we're
talking about 2 weeks.
If you or a caller will remind me, we'll talk about why the Black Sheep have become such a well-known name in connection with World War II.
And you're right. It's one of the more extraordinary groups that we've ever had.
And yes, they were extremely successful on what their mission was, but there were an awful lot of groups that were extremely successful with their mission.
Well, Brian Barrett is pointing a 30-06 at me right now, so we're going to have to cut off early. And Greg, it's always a great show, and I really enjoy being with you. It's always a lot of fun.
We'll see you in 2 weeks.
Yeah.